Men's sector.
Personally, I rock your body. I promise you go home, you won't tell daddy. I give it to you like you never had it. Screaming, judging, chill like speaking Chinese. Now waiting me this, pack a boom boom. Now waiting I see, Zaga, cause she know one day. She talks so she know one day.
I know go lie, the things within my mind. When I see you dancing, girl, you got me high. And if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood, as long as you're feeling the groove, I deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally, professionally, I see what you're doing intentionally.
Get me wanted physically.
So give it to me radically. Emotionally, psychologically, you're turning me on biologically. Sexually, dramatically, and she talks that she know one day.
I know go lie, the things within my mind. When I see you dancing, girl, you got me high. And if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood, as long as you're feeling the good, I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
Yeah, exceptionally, no reason as spiritually, money speaking so drastically, magically, internationally, Abba, abatically, grammar, not for dictionary, Saga, cause she know one day, she talks that she know one day.
I know go lie, the things within my mind, when I see you dancing, girl, you got me high, and if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood, as long as you're feeling the groove, I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
Hello, kia ora, assalamu alaikum, jambo, namaste, male, salam no. The Rasarul Radio, this is Rasarul Radio brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM 104.6. You're asked for this 1 hour show, Galwak Shul, and I welcome you today, this Saturday on 11 May 2019. And my colleague is not here with me this evening, but he might be on the way coming. The traffic is fine. Hope everything will be all right. Okay, a few things before we kick off. There's maybe if you have been listening to the mainstream media, you will hear that there's an issue of measles. So the measles has, you know, there's a measles outbreak in the North Island. So now the health professionals and the doctors and the hospitals and the government is telling families to vaccinate the children. because it is a threat. It becomes a threat. We don't hear a lot of these things for the last, I don't know how many years now, but, you know, things are turning around, and now we have the measles in New Zealand, and that's not the right thing. It's not good, but we need to protect our kids. We need to protect our children from measles by vaccinating them. So what you can do as a parent, just take them to the your GP. I think, but it is the same opinion to everyone as well, that the vaccination is free. It's free for kids. It's free for the adults. So it does not cost you anything. What is needed is your time, your commitment, and that your child will be a measles-free child. So this is an obligation as a parent. I got kids too, and I have to get myself vaccinated. I was vaccinated a few years ago. Looks like 6 to 7 years ago when I traveled back home, because I originally come from South Sudan. I would not come here without being vaccinated, because it's a very high case of all those diseases, measles, malaria, all those kind of diseases that are there. So it's good to be vaccinated. It's good for you, and it's good for the rest of the community, because you will not, you know, infect them. Because as I heard it, it was passed on by one person who came overseas, and now it's like it's getting everywhere in New Zealand. I don't have much statistics, but, you know, there's a lot of talk about that by health professionals, that is getting worse. And to make it even worse than what it is now, some parents do not want their kids to be vaccinated. This is not good. It shouldn't happen, I think, because they doubt the vaccine. But if you are not a doctor, why would you doubt the vaccine? I would not, because I have no clue about it. I have no idea about it. If the health professionals say that this is a good vaccine for that particular disease, measles, I would trust that, because I have no idea. I'm not a medical professional. I don't have any medical background. You know, it's a painful to me if I hear that some parents do resist taking their kids for vaccination. Because why I say that? Because I came from a region where we don't have those vaccines. We don't have to be vaccinated, because there's no vaccination anyway. If the disease comes, if the person dies, then the person dies, that person will be buried, and then the life will continue. Because we don't have anything to produce to prevent the disease. But here is knocking on our doors. Please get the kids vaccinated. This is a very good thing. You know, there are people here who do not know how lucky they are to live in New Zealand. Really, honestly, to be honest with you, it's lucky to be here. Because if you go out there and come back, you will easily understand those health professionals, what are they talking about. Yep, get your kids vaccinated, get yourself vaccinated, and everybody you know, and spread the word. Let us kick this measles out of New Zealand. Yep, that's the first thing first message that I want to send across. This Saturday, the 25th, Saturday the 25th, there's African Festival, African Arts Festival. So it's African Festival. It comes every year in every May in each year. And this is celebrated with music, with food, with love. It's a community. It's a type of atmosphere where families come together, community comes together, and have fun and enjoy this peace we have in New Zealand. Because not a lot of people have this peace, but we have it. It is something we have to celebrate. So that's what it means for African Festival. So please, if you have time, it will happen in Wellesley Community Center at Mount Roscoe, or you can go to the Facebook for a coffee. It's African Communities, page. You can just Google it up and then find it out. So, yeah, that being said, I want you guys to listen to the story. It's a story time. Why we like stories? Why do I like stories? Because I grew up in that environment where I was surrounded by elders. And then when elders talk, I don't go anywhere. I just sit there, consume all that richness of historical telling thing. It just glued myself to it. I kind of took myself out of it. So I have to sit down and listen to those stories, how the one person is talking at a time. And, there's no limit. They can't even talk until the midnight. And then it will continue tomorrow. And that's the routine. That richness, there's passing of information, that passing of knowledge from one generation to another generation. That's where I come from. That's where I grew up. And coming here to New Zealand, I always connect with people by telling my story, because if you don't know me, hi, how are you? That's not enough alone. That's not enough. So we have to come to that point where we change the channel, change the channel, get to the other side of the world, try to hear that person, what his background is like. So this is where it gets me, it gets me to it. So let's listen to one of the guys here. This guy is a Kenyan, he's from Kenya. His name is Joseph Kaia. And it is from the Maasai people of Kenya. Very great people, very lovely people. I love them. If you know a little bit about the Maasai people, maybe you know them about Maasai Mara. It's an animal park. And it's not only that. These people have a very rich culture in Kenya. Not only in Kenya, but in Africa. And they are lovely. And there are about 450,000 people. So I think Joseph said it too, about 450,000 people. So what I like about the history of Joseph is because it connects me with him, with the journey, with the background I came from. I grew up in that hardship, you have to find your way to survive. He was talking about being a hero. I went through the same passage again in different countries in South Sudan where I come from. So you are expected to endure all that pain. It's a part of induction in a way, but let's hear it from Joseph, what he was saying, and then we will be talking about it. There are more to come. So, by the way, he was talking at a TED Talk, Africa, and I thought it's amazing.
I took one more step. One more step. I just saw something huge. It was a lion attack. I heard another warrior say, "Hey, lelolo gwaru, lelolo gwaru." It was too late for me to look on the side. The lion was already on top of me, kicked me 3 meters up in the air, and thank you. We have been walking for 13 hours from 3 a.m. We lost hope and we started heading back home. I took one more step. One more step. I just saw something huge. It was a lion attack. I heard another warrior say, "Hey, lelolo gwaru, lelolo gwaru." It was too late for me to look on the side. The lion was already on top of me, kicked me 3 meters up in the air, and by the time I looked up, one of them, I just had one warrior said, "Edward Morani, he's dead." He shaked me off. All the jewelries that I had were completely off, and that was a moment that I thought that I was dead. In the Maasai culture, warriors, we are not allowed to go to the hospital. It's completely a taboo. When you go, it's like you're an odd out in the society. They tried all what they can to treat me in the village. They tried all the natural medicine they could treat me with. And my left leg kept on swelling and swelling and swelling. The elders, which are a very strong backbone in our society, they decided to make a decision that if the modern medicine, if the hospital is the last solution for him to survive, let's make a conclusion and take him to the hospital. 3 days we walked to this modern nice hospital, whereby all the people who worked in this hospital, they were non-Maasai. They looked at my leg and they said, "We have never seen a case like this." The leg was completely numbed, and they had to call a volunteer doctor, which I heard, or I learned later, he was from Britain. He came and looked at my leg and he said, "Wow, this looks interesting. It's beyond repair." And he told one of the senior doctors in the hospital, "I think the only option for this person to live is to amputate his leg." That was when I stood up in the bed and I said, "No, no, no, no." And he said, "All this long that I've been trying to look for someone to speak English, you speak English?" And I told him, "Yeah, I went to school, but because of the rite of passage of every Maasai, I decided to be a warrior, because when you become a warrior, you feel powerful. The whole society is looking at you, and you provide all what the society needs, and security, entertainment, and you can get what you want as a warrior." This is really interesting. "You tell me whatever it will take if you get healed." I said, "I'll do whatever you want." We became friends 1 month and a half in the hospital. And he told me that, "I'll try all my best, but you have to promise me to go back home, shave off your head, and go back to school and dedicate all your life into conservation." In our culture, when you shave your head, it's a big deal, because when you leave culture and go to education, it's like living in two worlds. And everybody was saying, "What?" All my age mates were saying, "This is not right." I did, because I had to do it, because I made a promise. I went to school for 5 years, and often I go back to Loita, where I come from. Kenya is not big. It's made of 42 tribes, and the Maasai people are among the minority that lives among the 42 million people that lives in Kenya. 450,000 Maasai that live in Kenya. I go every time, and I was lucky. I got married to the most beautiful wife in the world, as you can see. She's beautiful. And we were blessed. We had children. I got a job in one of the most luxurious camps, I will say, in the world, Sanctuary Olonana, as a guide. What does it mean, as a guide? My life went back into conservation. I meet so many people all over the world. In 2004, I drove my Land Cruiser to pick a client, and I was so honored that it was Bill Gates that everybody knows all over the world. We were blessed with 4 children. And I go back to the village, and my children were growing. And my wife one day told me that, "You know what? Our children are growing and they need to go to school." I told her, "I will sleep and I'll give you an answer tomorrow." I did not even sleep, trying to think a way that I can convince my wife that our children will get educated. The nearest school to my village is 60 kilometers. There are only 2 options. For us never to educate our children, or for us to move away from my culture and my people and educate our children in a town. And I said, "This is not right. My children will grow not knowing their grandparents, their cousins, their aunts. I have to find a solution." I went back to work. I spoke to a lot of government politicians. I went to many offices all over Kenya. And I said, "I have an idea, and nobody's going to stop me from using this idea. I have a career. I have a job that I meet people all over the world. I'll speak to the world, and I'll change my community." In 2009, we built a school through an organization called Under the Acacia. And when we built this school, a teeny, teeny classroom, we had an opportunity to be able to accommodate only 40 kids in that school. That moment, I said, oh my God, I was so nervous. I did not know that anybody can send kids into this school. We started the registration of the children, and by midday, we had 118 kids that turned up to come to the school. I smile in my heart. And I said, when I stood in front of all the elders, I said, this is the beginning of something good to my community. I worked so hard because, as you know, that Kenya have gone through a lot of challenges, constitutional. The government of Kenya announced to everybody that education is free. So I said, how can this be sustainable? I need this to be going on and on and on. We believe that God is nature. We believe in respecting each other and, above all, respecting other people's culture. I say the Maasai people are not poor. They live over the land. A Maasai can pay for water. A Maasai can pay for health care. And what is the meaning of having a school if you don't have water? And what is the meaning of a school if you don't have health care? So we started a program in our community, and we elected prominent leaders that are monitoring each project, from water, health, and the school, that all the projects are sustainable to each other. In Kenya, when you want to build a school, it will take only you 1 week, and you can instantly provide education to the young children. I know in America, when you want to build a school, it will take millions of years for you to get a license, millions of dollars for you to build a school. In Kenya, you can provide, like, instant education to the young children. I also encourage what we call women empowerment, because in our culture, there are a lot of things that, like lion hunting, female circumcision, or cattle raiding, that the Western world or other cultures, they look at the Maasai and they say that these are not right. I believe that. But for my culture, to move forward, they have to change other ways of life. And I decided to build this community, which is an area of about 150,000 people. We still have a long journey to go. And my community, in 2 years, when we finish whatever we are doing, will be able to net about $100,000 after we deducted all the employees, which our institution will have about 60,000 people that are, 60 people that are employed to work in our schools. I don't want this to end. I want this to be a role model to the world, not only to Kenya. Wherever that is remote in Kenya, that you can admire the beauty of, when you went to later, 10 years ago, you can only see the trees and see the grass. I want it to be a role model that we can use to other communities. And above all, I want this to be a memorable moment that everybody who comes from a remote area should know that every human being, wherever you are in the world, you have the voice to talk to the world, and the world can change the community that you come from. And that moment, when the lion nearly killed me, I look back now and I see that it was just a beginning of a new life. Thank you very much.
Yeah, welcome back. This is Galwaxul. The host for the day. This is Resilient Radio, brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM 104.6. And you have just been listening to a speech given by Joseph Kaye. He's from Kenya, a Maasai, a warrior. And it's a very moving story. We will have some reflections after this music played by the Ugandan musician Edo Kenzo. Enjoy and stay tuned.
Dance, Gun me, she made him, let the food just
Hello, okay, haura, salam alaikum. Jambo, jambo sana, namaste, salam now. You have been listening to Resolo Radio, brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM 104.6. I'm the host for this 1 hour show, Galwakshul, today, Saturday, May 11th, 2019. And we have been talking about the history. The history, you know, storytelling connects people. And by the way, what is singing is a group of dancers from South Sudan. For those people who do not know South Sudan is the youngest nation on planet. It was founded, not it was founded, it gained its independence on the 9th July 2011. So this is a new nation, and it's a new country, and it has been through so many civil wars in the history of civil wars. And I was born in that war. So two wars, one war before I was born, and then they had a break of about maybe a few years, like 6-7 years, and then it resumed again, and then I was born in that. So I grew up in war, and so my struggle all the time is about how I can define myself, how I can create a hope when there's no hope. And this is what I describe as my resettlement journey. And the story that you have listened before from Joseph Kaye is a Maasai guy. Maasai is one of the 450, not just one, is a 450 million tribe in 42 tribes in Kenya, even said it themselves. So they have a very good culture, the Maasai culture, and it's always a vibrant culture. You have to be a warrior if you are a man, and the women are all behind that, and a powerful community. And, you know, they are nomads, going after the cattle, going after the animals. So what has amazed me from the story told by Joseph Kaye is how strong he is, because he said when he was struck down by a lion, so his friends thought he was dead, and it's not a culture that he should be taken to the hospital, because if you have to be taken to hospital, then you are weak. It does not belong to the culture that you have to seek the modern medicine, that you have to come out of that like part of your strength. And what struck me from his history is the attack of the lion is what got him into be educated. You know, he was never educated before. He never went to his school. And so he was starting all over from scratch. He's just a warrior in the village there. He had no idea about the school. He had no idea about, you know, the civil life. He was happy with the things he was doing. But as he said, you know, for one bad thing to happen is the beginning of another good journey. And that's how we put it. So we all connect through the storytelling. And I have learned a lot from him, from what he said. So if you did not follow, you can Google that. It's part of the TED Talk, and you can just put Joseph Kaye there. Joseph Kaye. Kaye is K-A-Y-I-E. And so you will hear his speech there. It's very amazing. And in Africa, we say it takes a village to raise a child. What that means is because a boy is supposed to be a protector of the community, and being raised, you don't belong to that family, so you belong to the village, and so it is the responsibility of the whole village to take care of that boy. Not that they will come to the family, feed you, you know, bring milk, feed you with food and all the things you need, the basic things. No, it's not like that. So elders in that village have to mentor you how to be the eye of the village, the eye of the community, the eye of the people. And that's the passage he has gone through. After he was struck down by a lion, and then he was taken to the medical hospital, and he met the British doctor, and so the connection started from there. But through his story, he began to build the confidence that, hey, you know, I can go back. It took him 5 years to go back to school and try to learn. It was not too late. He did not tell how old he was because he did not know how old he was, you know, when he started going to school, because there is no age record there. He didn't know. So I thought it's a very powerful, and according to him, he walked, you know, 60 kilometers to go to his school. That's what I used to do. You know, I was living on the other side of the river in South Sudan, because we have the river called Sobat River. Sobat River is connected with the Nile River, and it's, the current is very strong there. So what I used to do, I swim twice, going to school in the morning and coming back from school. So there's nothing called lunch, no lunch there. It is what I refer to as my resilience, you know. And I did not even know how many kilometers. It might be more than 60 kilometers a day, because I go in the morning, coming back at night. So it's all work, and you have to do it 5 days a week. Just like he said, we never talk about the weather. It's raining, you have to go. There's a storm, you have to go. It's a way of life. There's nothing called, oh, no, there's, you know, the weather is not friendly, so the class is canceled. You don't even know whether there's bad weather or not. So you just see the sky. If the sky is clear, then you go. If it's raining, you come back later on in the rain. So this is part of the journey. And I thought also his story, Joseph's story, relates to another story told by another lady, a writer. But this is a flip side of it. Joseph comes from the rural life, and the other girl that I'm going to introduce to you is a Nigerian girl grown up in a university, in a campus, because raised by a highly skilled parents. So she has grown into this, into books, into writing, and then she became a poet. And it is a tendency completely different from where Joseph comes from. So I'm trying to connect two worlds here, whether they would make any sense to you, but it's good to give a comparison. This girl's name is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie from Nigeria. So she has a different side story. So Chimamanda is talking about the things we always say here in ARCC, Atorora Settled Community Coalition. It's a group of communities from refugee background, communities having been here for like a long time, and it's called home to them. They don't know any other home, because where we came from, we were forced out. We did not have a choice to come here, and we live in other countries, you know, hosting us as refugees before we came here. And when we come here, stories are told differently. So we are being called different names, you know, like, this is a refugee. I'm not a refugee. I'm a New Zealander. What do you mean? Are you telling me I'm not part of the society? So this is where the angle of Chimamanda comes from. The danger of a single story. The danger of a single story. One side story. One side story does not tell the perspective of the whole thing. This is a tiny part of it, and it does not. It's not a representative of the whole part. And I think if I can take you all through it, I think it would be good. So listen to her, and if we have time later, we can come back and reflect from that. Have a good time and enjoy.
Although I think four is probably close to the truth. So I was an early reader. and what I read were British and American children's books. I was also an early writer. And when I began to write at about the age of 7, stories in pencil with crayon illustrations that my poor mother was obligated to read, I wrote exactly the kinds of stories I was reading. All my characters were white and blue-eyed. They played in the snow. They ate apples. And they talked a lot about the weather, how lovely it was that the sun had come out. Now, this despite the fact that I lived in Nigeria. I had never been outside Nigeria. We didn't have snow. We ate mangoes. And we never talked about the weather because there was no need to. My characters also drank a lot of ginger beer because the characters in the British books I read drank ginger beer. Never mind that I had no idea what ginger beer was. And for many years afterwards, I would have a desperate desire to taste ginger beer. But that is another story. What this demonstrates, I think, is how impressionable and vulnerable we are in the face of a story, particularly as children. Because all I had read were books in which characters were foreign, I had become convinced that books, by their very nature, had to have foreigners in them and had to be about things with which I could not personally identify. Now, things changed when I discovered African books. There weren't many of them available, and they weren't quite as easy to find as the foreign books, but because of writers like Chinua Achebe and Kamara Laye, I went through a mental shift in my perception of literature. I realized that people like me, girls with skin the color of chocolate, whose kinky hair could not form ponytails, could also exist in literature. I started to write about things I recognized. Now, I loved those American and British books I read. They stirred my imagination. They opened up new worlds for me. But the unintended consequence was that I did not know that people like me could exist in literature. So what the discovery of African writers did for me was this. It saved me from having a single story of what books are. I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. My father was a professor. My mother was an administrator. And so we had, as was the norm, living domestic help who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new houseboy. His name was Fide. The only thing my mother told us about him was that his family was very poor. My mother sent yams and rice and our old clothes to his family. And when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, "Finish your food. Don't you know people like Fide's family have nothing?" So I felt enormous pity for Fide's family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit. And his mother showed us a beautifully patterned basket made of dyed raffia that his brother had made. I was startled. It had not occurred to me that anybody in his family could actually make something. All I had heard about them was how poor they were, so that it had become impossible for me to see them as anything else but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them. Years later, I thought about this when I left Nigeria to go to university in the United States. I was 19. My American roommate was shocked by me. She asked where I had learned to speak English so well and was confused when I said that Nigeria happened to have English as its official language. She asked if she could listen to what she called my tribal music and was consequently very disappointed when I produced my tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that I did not know how to use a stove. What struck me was this. She had felt sorry for me even before she saw me. Her default position toward me as an African was a kind of patronizing, well-meaning pity. My roommate had a single story of Africa, a single story of catastrophe. In this single story, there was no possibility of Africans being similar to her in any way, no possibility of feelings more complex than pity, no possibility of a connection as human equals. I must say that before I went to the U.S., I didn't consciously identify as African. But in the U.S., whenever Africa came up, people turned to me, never mind that I knew nothing about places like Namibia. But I did come to embrace this new identity, and in many ways I think of myself now as African, although I still get quite irritable when Africa is referred to as a country, the most recent example being my otherwise wonderful flight from Lagos 2 days ago, in which there was an announcement on the Virgin flight about their charity walk in India, Africa, and other countries. So after I had spent some years in the US as an African, I began to understand my roommate's response to me. If I had not grown up in Nigeria, and if all I knew about Africa were from popular images, I too would think that Africa was a place of beautiful landscapes, beautiful animals, and incomprehensible people fighting senseless wars, dying of poverty and AIDS, unable to speak for themselves, and waiting to be saved by a kind white foreigner. I would see Africans in the same way that I, as a child, had seen Fide's family. This single story of Africa ultimately comes, I think, from Western literature. Now, here's a quote from the writing of a London merchant called John Locke, who sailed to West Africa in 1561 and kept a fascinating account of his voyage. After referring to the black Africans as beasts who have no houses, he writes, "They are also people without heads, having their mouths and eyes in their breasts." Now, I've laughed every time I've read this, and one must admire the imagination of John Locke. But what is important about his writing is that it represents the beginning of a tradition of telling African stories in the West, a tradition of sub-Saharan Africa as a place of negatives, of difference, of darkness, of people who, in the words of the wonderful poet Rudyard Kipling, are half devil, half child. And so I began to realize that my American roommate must have, throughout her life, seen and heard different versions of this single story. As had a professor who once told me that my novel was not authentically African. Now, I was quite willing to contend that there were a number of things wrong with the novel, that it had failed in a number of places, but I had not quite imagined that it had failed at achieving something called African authenticity. In fact, I did not know what African authenticity was. The professor told me that my characters were too much like him, an educated and middle-class man. My characters drove cars. They were not starving. Therefore, they were not authentically African. But I must quickly add that I, too, am just as guilty on the question of the single story. A few years ago, I visited Mexico from the U.S. The political climate in the U.S. at the time was tense, and there were debates going on about immigration. And, as often happens in America, immigration became synonymous with Mexicans. There were endless stories of Mexicans as people who were fleecing the healthcare system, sneaking across the border, being arrested at the border, that sort of thing. I remember walking around on my first day in Guadalajara, watching the people going to work, rolling up tortillas in the marketplace, smoking, laughing. I remember first feeling slight surprise, and then I was overwhelmed with shame. I realized that I had been so immersed in the media coverage of Mexicans that they had become one thing in my mind, the abject immigrant. I had bought into the single story of Mexicans, and I could not have been more ashamed of myself. So that is how to create a single story. Show a people as one thing, as only one thing, over and over again, and that is what they become. It is impossible to talk about the single story without talking about power. There is a word, an Igbo word, that I think about whenever I think about the power structures of the world, and it is nkali. It's a noun that loosely translates to be greater than another. Like our economic and political worlds, stories too are defined by the principle of nkali. How they are told, who tells them, when they are told, how many stories are told, are really dependent on power. Power is the ability not just to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person. The Palestinian poet Mourid Barghouti writes that if you want to dispossess a people, the simplest way to do it is to tell their story and to start with secondly. Start the story with the arrows of the Native Americans and not with the arrival of the British, and you have an entirely different story. Start the story with the failure of the African state and not with the colonial creation of the African state, and you have an entirely different story. I recently spoke at a university where a student told me that it was such a shame that Nigerian men were physical abusers like the father character in my novel. I told him that I had just read a novel called American Psycho. And that it was such a shame that young Americans were serial murderers. Now, Now, obviously, I said this in a fit of mild irritation, but it would never have occurred to me to think that just because I had read a novel in which a character was a serial killer, that he was somehow representative of all Americans. And now, this is not because I am a better person than that student, but because of America's cultural and economic power, I had many stories of America. I had read Thailand, Updike, and Steinbeck, and Gaitskill. I did not have a single story of America. When I learned some years ago that writers were expected to have had really unhappy childhoods to be successful, I began to think about how I could invent horrible things my parents had done to me. But the truth is that I had a very happy childhood, full of laughter and love, in a very close-knit family. But I also had grandfathers who died in refugee camps. My cousin, Polly, died because he could not get adequate health care. One of my closest friends, Okoloma, died in a plane crash because our fire trucks did not have water. I grew up under repressive military governments that devalued education so that sometimes my parents were not paid their salaries. And so as a child, I saw jam disappear from the breakfast table. Then margarine disappeared. Then bread became too expensive. Then milk became rationed. And most of all, a kind of normalized political fear invaded our lives. All of these stories make me who I am. But to insist on only these negative stories is to flatten my experience and to overlook the many other stories that formed me.
And welcome back. And this is Ishimamanda from Nigeria, and she's telling the danger of telling one story of a storytelling from one side, one viewpoint, and this is what you're saying, and it's very connecting, and I hope you get something out of it, and we will continue next Saturday, next week, and have a great week.
But I'm not about to
from the studio,
and it's very important. It's bye-bye. Just as important to talk about them. I've always felt that it is impossible to engage properly with a place or a person without engaging with all of them.
That was our show for this week.
Take care until next Saturday, same time, 10 to 5, on Planet FM 104.6.
And on the web, www.plantaudio.org.nz/reset.